This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Everyone talks about the power of positive thinking, but just how much can our attitude affect outcomes? And what happens when you couple this with the placebo effect? Do our minds really have an effect on our treatments? Researchers at Harvard Medical School studied migraine sufferers to just try to answer this question. The study was published this week in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Ted Kapchuk is a co-author of that study, professor of medicine at Harvard Med School, director of the program in placebo studies at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks a lot for inviting me back.
You're welcome. Tell us how you set up this study.
Well, we recruited 66 patients with migraines, and we told them we wanted to observe seven different acute attacks, not for their benefit, but for the benefit of science and medicine. The first headache we observed was a no-treatment baseline control. We just watched them for 2.5 hours, no medication. For the next six migraine attacks, we randomly gave patients either placebo or a genuine medication, in this case Maxalt, for each one of the headaches. And when we gave them placebos, when we gave them the pills, the envelope said three different things depending on the three different headaches. Once it would say, we gave them three different expectations, a low, medium, and high expectation, by putting different words on the envelope. The first one envelope said placebo, a second envelope said either placebo or the genuine drug Maxalt. The third envelope said Maxalt. When we gave them the drugs on three of the headaches, we had the same labels with low, medium, and high expectations saying either placebo or placebo or Maxalt or Maxalt. And that's what we did to the patients. And we got these stunning findings that are kind of remarkable.
Tell us about what you found.
Well, the first thing that was we did expect, is that the bigger the placebo effect, the higher the expectation, the bigger the placebo effect was, and the bigger the drug effect was. But what was really interesting, under each one of those different expectations, more than 50% of the drug effect was attributable to the placebo effect. So let me give you a very, very simple example of the many things that were going on in the study. When we gave them the drug and labeled it Maxalt, genuine drug, the effect of that drug was no different than when we gave them a placebo and labeled it Maxalt. Just changing a single word, a word with a lot of meaning, made the placebo as good as the drug and made the drug no different than the placebo.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was interesting. Very amazing, the study.
Because we usually think that the placebo effect works in about 30% of people.
Well,
but you're saying it's a lot more here.
Well, I think the way what we did here is we did it much more accurately. We put it on the different kinds of expectations. We compared it many different ways. And the most important thing is we had a no-treatment control. When you say the placebo effect is something, I think it's more mythic that it's always 30%, depending on the condition and stuff. You don't have a control for the placebo effect. In drug trials, we compare the drug to placebo. But in fact, sometimes people who respond in the placebo arm of a trial, some of it's just time makes people better or spontaneous remission. This was a much more carefully designed study. In fact, there's never been a study that compared no treatment to the placebo effect in migraine and very few other conditions that's ever happened.
So what do you tell migraine patients? People with migraines
Well, you know, I'm not the migraine specialist in this study. This is Rami Burstein. I'm the placebo expert in this study. But I think the message here is that a positive message is important. And in this particular study, the effect of a positive message was equal to the pharmacology of the drug. And I think that in the same way that we that a physician has to calculate very carefully what pharmaceutical I have to give and how much milligrams do I have to give of that drug, he or she may need to calculate the exact right words to accompany the pharmaceutical. In this study, the words actually double the effect of the placebo or cut the effect of the drug in half. What exactly those words are, I think that's more research, because this experiment was a proof of concept. We really wanted to see if words work. And then we have to now figure out what's the ethical way of providing a positive message that's true, accurate, and is not an exaggeration and distortion, because obviously truth in healthcare, trust in healthcare is real critical.
And you're
but
saying...
Clearly,
yeah.
We need more discussion of what's the positive message that should be that should surround a drug that's ethically permissible.
Any drug, not just the migraine drug.
I don't know if the findings of this study apply to every drug and every condition,
yeah.
But I suspect that it applies to many conditions, especially when the outcome is a patient's self-appraisal, self-report, or what's called subjective outcome, pain, fatigue, nausea, dizziness. If there's no measure for that, there's a lot of wobble, and the placebo effect is probably most effective. I don't want to make it grandiose, say this the finding applies to all drugs,
right.
But in fact it applies to a very good drug. Maxalt is much better than placebo, but its overall effect is linearly affected by the effect of the placebo.
And what were there special positive words that you used?
No, the only words there's only three words in this study. we gave them all the envelopes at the same time. The first treatment was no treatment.
It said no treatment.
You know, they just sat there for 2.5
yeah.
hours and got, and
yeah.
most people got much worse. Or, and when we gave them the envelopes, the only words on the envelope were placebo, one word.
Right.
The second envelope was placebo or Maxalt, the active drug, and that was our medium expectation, or the envelope said Maxalt, the genuine drug, which is our high expectation. We only changed three words in this study,
wow.
And we were able to make and these words obviously have a lot of meaning, and they're very
right.
potent words, but they really totally changed the placebo effect and the medication effect.
And even people who knew they were getting the placebo.
Oh, that was really an interesting finding in this study. When one of the six headaches we treated, the envelope said placebo and really was a placebo. Those people, then this is all the people, this is every single patient was used as their own control. We had more than 500 mm-hmm. headaches here. The headaches that had, I'm taking a placebo and I know it's a placebo, improved 30% from the baseline no treatment control. Actually, the biggest improvement per condition in the study was just taking a pill, even if you knew it was a placebo pill.
That is that 30% matches the placebo rate. That
yeah, but yeah. It's I don't want to make a generalization
yeah,
about a placebo effect.
But what is so how do you what do you attribute that to? They know they're taking placebo and
yeah, I you know, first of all, in this study we didn't do an investigation of what the mechanism was. In fact, we were surprised that we got this result. But I attribute it to, it's not that you think you're going to get better, you're going to get better, but your body knows. It's in a kind of embodied cognition or a bodily memory that's below the level of consciousness. And when we take those, I'm speculating now.
Yeah.
We take those medications, we take any kind of pills in the context of a healthcare situation, that the body has a response even below the level of consciousness.
Wow.
And our team actually recently published a nice paper in PNAS showing that when we gave positive expectations of improvement of pain alleviation, for 0.12 seconds, that's 12 milliseconds, below the possibility of being consciously aware, we were able to get placebo responses.
Wow.
I'm thinking that's what it is. More research has to be done.
Right. And you're the man to do it, I think.
I'm going to try really hard.
All right, Ted. Thanks. It's very interesting. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Happy New Year.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Ted Kabchuk is a professor of medicine at Harvard Med School and the director of the program in placebo studies at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. If you're in Las Vegas this week, step away from the tables for a minute and take your chips down to the Consumer Electronics Show. For all you gadget geeks and tech nerds, this is your week. It's a peek at what technology will be big in 2014, or at least what they think will be big in 2014, because you know the track record is not terribly good when they predict at the CES. They're talking about smartwatches. There are curved TVs. Is that going to be the future? And Toyota announced their new fuel cell car there, powered by hydrogen. Chris Ziegler is deputy managing editor of The Verge, and he's on the line with us now. It's must be hard to cover a conference that big.
It really is. It takes a huge team. We have over six. Our publication has over 60 people here covering the show, and I swear it's still not enough.
Sum up the show in a few words for me. What is it?
The show is really the place. It's kind of two different shows in one. On the public-facing side, you have the journalists covering all these amazing gadgets, these whiz-bang devices that you're seeing on television, that you're going to see in stores over the course of the year. And then the other part of the show that you don't see is these same companies meeting with buyers to set up who's buying what over the course of the year to put in the stores.
I see. You know, because I've been reading the papers, and they say that this show has turned in effectively into a new car show.
It really has. You know, it's been a growing trend for, I'd say, probably 5 years now, maybe even longer. Ford, in particular, has been going for a long time. But this year, it really turned the corner. Virtually every automaker at least has people here, and many have booths, like full-out booths.
Wow. So the new high-tech gadget is a car. It's no longer your phone. The new electronic gadget is going to be your car.
That's right. You know, I've said for a long time that the car is the biggest gadget you'll ever own. And for many people, that really is true. And it's unconnected at this point, and there really is no good reason for that. There are so many ways to not just make driving more entertaining, because really it's not about entertainment at the end of the day. It's about making driving safer. We're seeing a lot of technologies here that can help do that.
Let's talk about the Toyota announcing its hydrogen fuel cell car.
Yes.
Wow. And they're very serious about it, right?
They are. They're actually committing to bringing it to the United States in 2015, and it's actually going to be a global launch. It will be in other countries as well. But, you know, it's a very tempered announcement, because really at the end of the day, fuel cells need infrastructure, right? You need a way to fuel these vehicles, and that infrastructure doesn't currently exist. So it's only going to be a launch in California at first, because the state has already committed about $200 million to helping build that infrastructure. But even so, they're only going to have about 20 new fuel stations in 2015. So it's going to be a pretty limited rollout.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI. Talking with Chris Ziegler, Deputy Managing Editor of The Verge. So Toyota might be giving Elon Musk a run, a little bit of competition.
That's right. And Elon has kind of given fuel cells a hard time recently. He's not a believer. And there are very good reasons for skepticism. Like I mentioned, the infrastructure is a huge problem. But the vehicle is practical. They're promising 300 miles of range, which is, you know, as good as a gasoline car.
Mm-hmm. And so there are other announcements. As you say, a lot of auto announcements. Google announced an Open Automotive Alliance. What is that?
So that's kind of a two-tier announcement. The first part of that is going to be kind of a concentrated effort by Google and a handful of automakers, including GM, Audi, Hyundai, and a couple others, to ease the interface between Android smartphones and the car. So, for instance, and this is not something Google has said, by the way, I'm speculating, mm-hmm. but it's easy to imagine that, say, 3 or 4 years down the road, you could have a voice interface to all of the applications on your phone, the idea being that you're not looking at your phone while you're driving. Which, you know, of course, we've all heard what a huge problem texting while driving is, and that's extending to other applications on the phone as well. So that's an obvious application. Then longer term, mm-hmm. we'll start to see cars that are actually powered by Android.
Mm-hmm. Now, in getting back to the gadgets, the smaller gadgets, I saw something about a curved TV.
Yes.
Why do we want a curved TV?
That's actually a very good question. The companies that are making these televisions, LG and Samsung chiefly, will tell you that the big advantage is that they reduce glare. And it is true. If you're looking at the TV dead on, you get far less glare on a curved display than you do on a flat display. But you can imagine, I mean, the counter argument is that mounting it would just look weird because you have this object that's curving away from your wall. So it goes both ways. I actually think it's kind of a gimmick, just like 3D was a few years ago. That's kind of almost died off completely in the home at this point. I'm not sure curved TVs are going to be a big deal either.
Yeah, you know, 3D never caught on. What about the 4K TVs? That's something that's going to catch on, and exactly what do we mean by 4K?
Yeah, 4K is a much bigger deal. So 4K is the next step in resolution. We all remember the transition from standard definition to high definition, which is, you know, 720p, 1080i, 1080p.
Right.
And now the next step is 4K, which is much, much higher resolution. You can't really appreciate it when you're just looking at a 4K set dead on, but when you compare 1080p to 4K side by side, which, of course, we're able to do at CES, you really can tell the difference. And that it is going to be a big deal. In probably 5 to 7 years, every home is going to have a 4K TV.
Is that because the screens are so big? You need that kind of resolution?
Yeah, screens are definitely getting larger. And to be fair, once you get under, say, 45 to 50 inches, it doesn't make that big of a difference because the individual pixels on the screen are so much smaller. But once you get to 60, 78 inch, 80 inches, that's where you can really see the difference.
And so we're going to have all these, the bandwidth to be able to get 4K.
That's right. And you know, the sort of proliferation of high-speed internet connections is definitely helping to enable this.
Yeah.
Netflix has announced that they're filming all future original series in 4K. Samsung announced a number of 4K distribution deals, so that the infrastructure is finally in place to actually get 4K content to these TVs.
Yeah. Well, good luck covering all of that, Chris. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Get some time out there and play a little blackjack. Chris Ziegler is the Deputy Managing Editor of The Verge.